Welcome to the Crisis Vote, a half hour of information on the global electoral crisis. I'm Dori Smith. Today, part two of an interview taped Wednesday, January 19th, with Dar Jamail in Baghdad. Dar Jamail is an independent reporter from Alaska. He's been reporting from Iraq for roughly 8 months throughout the war and occupation. His work is largely for Free Speech Radio News, Flashpoints, and the BBC. His articles are also published in New Standard News, Common Dreams, The Nation Online, Alternet, and many other publications. You can read his daily dispatches home from Iraq at darjamailiraq.com, darjamailiraq.com. Today we spoke about the political climate in the United States as George Bush is inaugurated, and the political climate in Iraq as elections are pending in a very hostile climate. I wanted to ask you, Dar, about the corporations in Iraq and whether or not the elections on the 30th might favor their schedules and timetables for their investments in the region as much or more than the timetable favors any U.S. policy.
Well, it's really not going to affect it, because what happened when the U.S. invaded Iraq, one of the first things it did to break the Hague Conventions, actually, was to rewrite the laws of the country, which is illegal, of course, by international law. But in so doing, it wrote the laws. They started out as the Bremer Orders, as they were called, which were signed over to Ayad Alawi, the U.S. appointed interim prime minister, the day on June 28th, the day of the so-called transfer of power. And these orders, some of the things they mentioned was that they did open all businesses in Iraq to foreign interests, and also opened all the markets tax-free for foreign goods to come in. So, in effect, these contracts, these laws, none of this will be changed by this election whatsoever. So what we have on the ground in Iraq is companies that from the West, companies such as Bechtel and Halliburton and their subsidiary KBR, of course, who are operating here basically with free will to take as many of the contracts as they want, and they have. In fact, of all of the contracts awarded by USAID to all of the companies in Iraq to rebuild and engage in reconstruction contracts, only 2% of those contracts have gone to Iraqi concerns, and that's simply not changing, and that will not be changed by the elections whatsoever. And this is the primary reason why we have 70% unemployment, shattered infrastructure, and next to no reconstruction going on throughout most of Iraq. There's been some down in the Basra area and some up in the Kurdish north, but most of the rest of Iraq remains completely debilitated by the invasion and the lack of reconstruction, because these Western contractors are getting paid. They have cost-plus contracts, so they're getting paid even if they're not doing the work, which is what's happening right now.
Now, just as in America there are divisions in the concepts about Iraq, some in the military are talking about very dire consequences in the future, even worse, if you can imagine, than what we've been seeing. Others are talking about this democracy-building idea. In Iraq, it's very similar. We have some members of Alawi's inner circle talking about the success of the policies and the U.S. Occupation. And I would like you to talk about what you've actually seen on the ground as you've toured places in Iraq like Fallujah. What has been your experience? Are Fallujahans going to have the opportunity to vote, as Alawi suggests they will?
No, of course they will not, and they would not vote even given the opportunity, because they are absolutely disgusted with this policy that has done nothing but terrorize the Fallujahans, people in Ramadi, Samarra, all throughout central Iraq, as well as places even in the Shia-dominated south. So even given the opportunity, the people who've been disenfranchised by this occupation, particularly the Sunni population, absolutely will not be participating in it, and will not. They hate the policies here. They see nothing but destruction death and suffering all around Sandbox, and they hate Mr. Alawi because of this, because they view him simply as a puppet of the Bush administration, which he is, and a very good one at that. He has been on the CIA payroll in the past and maintains very strong links with the Bush administration. And if we listen to his talk, he sounds very much like Mr. Bush, in that he talks about terrorism and rooting out the terrorists and ruling with a strong, firm hand and this sort of thing. So the people saying that people in Fallujah or Samar will have an opportunity to vote is really, it's almost insulting, because they simply will not vote, even given the opportunity, because he's basically a modern-day Dresden, where the city has been literally bombed to the ground. At least 70% of all, 75% of all standing structures in the city have literally been demolished, and the remaining 25% have suffered some destruction as well. So this is a city, the beacon of the Bush policy of aggressively rooting out terrorism is Fallujah, where we have no electricity, no water, no infrastructure, no sewage system, no jobs, no life. Even large quadrants of the city remain barred by the U.S. military. They're barring people from even going to their homes. So then these people are going to be given an opportunity to vote in what they perceive to be a totally illegitimate election. It is it's a very deep insult to them, as many of the refugees I've interviewed about this have told me.
You know, one has to wonder why Fallujah was attacked the way it was. We were told that this was to battle insurgents. Then again, it's hard to define the insurgent in the mind of the U.S. military or the Bush administration anymore. We were first led to believe that America was going into Iraq to help Iraqis. Now it's hard to differentiate between Iraqi civilians, Iraqi insurgents. That certainly seemed to be the case in Fallujah, which was hit very, very hard. Of the many stories you have done, you have talked about torture in Abu Ghraib. You've talked about assaults that have taken the lives of many thousands of civilians. Talk a little bit about your more recent inquiries into unconventional weapons use in Fallujah.
Yes, I should start out by saying that even according to the Iraqi Red Crescent, they estimate very conservatively that 60% of the people killed in Fallujah, of at least 2,000 people, were not fighters. They were civilians. They were women, children, and the elderly. And all of the refugees I've interviewed from different parts of Fallujah coming out of siege at different times are all telling the same stories, that they've seen these very odd phosphorus-type weapons being used by the military, that they've seen the use of chemical weapons, that in fact there is photographic proof. You can see clearly on the skin of some of the dead that evidence of chemical and or phosphorus weapons having been used. There are consistent reports now coming out from people. Even I interviewed a man yesterday who literally came back from Fallujah last night, gone in to check on his home, and he saw that the U.S. military were excavating parts soil. They were literally using bulldozers to pile up large sand piles of the soil in areas where certain types of munitions were used, and loading it onto trucks to be carted out of the city. Other refugees have reported seeing the U.S. military bringing in water tanker trucks, not for the civilians trapped inside the city, but rather to use these to power blast the streets with water. Again, it looks very much like military attempts to hide their tracks from using these illegal weapons. And then, of course, we have the usual use of cluster bombs, which so many people reported back in April. Again, they're reporting the same thing this time. Cluster bombs are, of course, illegal under the Geneva Convention to use in an area where there might be any civilians whatsoever, which is, of course, the entire city of Fallujah. So all of these reports are coming out. They have been coming out since the beginning of the siege. They're coming out now, but it's a trickle because it's very difficult to get information. No journalists whatsoever being allowed inside the city by the U.S. military. And that, amongst all of these reports coming out from the refugees, really begs the question, why would the U.S. military not allow a journalist who wanted to, who accepted the risk of his life, even though there is ongoing fighting there, why would they not allow them to come into the city if they have done this great job of, quote-unquote, routing out the insurgents, creating a stable and secure Fallujah for its residents? Why would they not allow journalists to come in and report this?
Now, in the U.S., there has been a huge wave of humanitarian aid offered to victims in South Asia of the tsunami. And this disaster has called a lot of people to donate money and to become involved in trying to help. Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz headed to Indonesia last week and, upon speaking to the press, announced that America would be pulling out of Indonesia and allowing the Indonesian military to continue basically on its own without U.S. assistance in distributing aid. Talk a little bit about the whole nature of U.S. humanitarian aid as it relates to Iraq, where Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz now says those troops that have been helping South Asians are headed.
Well, it's viewed over in Iraq as insulting because we have a situation here in Iraq where at minimum 100,000 Iraqi civilians have died as a result of this brutal and failed occupation. And this huge outpouring of support for the tsunami victims, as beautiful as that is, it is insulting to Iraqis where their country has been invaded and shattered and continues to suffer on a daily basis. And there has been no organized governmental support from the U.S. come in here and show the same outpouring of support and financial and material assistance for these people who suffer just as much or more than the victims of the tsunami in the places where it struck. And it's just not happening here. And instead, we have ongoing heavy military operations, violence, and a security situation that's basically, there is no security here, and there's no hope for it to improve in the near future whatsoever. So that all of this support has gone, particularly from the U.S. government, going and making personal appearances by different officials, such as you mentioned, and there's been none of that here in Iraq, not even an honest acknowledgement that this is a crisis. There are ongoing humanitarian crises on a daily basis throughout Iraq, and there's been none of that same outpouring or let alone concern, just basic concern from any member of the Bush administration to come here and admit, yes, this is a catastrophe. We need to do whatever we can to help the situation, to help these people that we said we were coming to help liberate and assist. And that has simply not happened, and that is being viewed as an insult by so many Iraqis.
Human rights organizations, some of the lead agencies that would be, you know, looking at crises of the kind you're looking at, have all agreed that many thousands of civilians have died. Many thousands more have been injured. We have medical organizations providing up-to-the-minute reports on the disaster that you are seeing in Iraq, Dar Jamil. And so it's not a matter of lack of proof. Let's talk a little bit about lack of will. America was looked at for maybe five decades or more as a nation that could potentially lead the world in human rights and in promoting democracy, in promoting the Geneva Convention, setting standards for armed conflict law, international law. This has been the hope of so many people who have devoted their lives to trying to get various U.S. leaders on board with just international change and leading international change that could help civilians. How do you feel that things have shifted? Characterize the shift now as America is now looked at as the aggressor nation that must be challenged in a court of law, in an international court, perhaps the International Court of Justice at The Hague, that's been tried before. But in various places, the new ICC, International Criminal Court. Just describe the dynamic, if you can.
Well, I'll keep it with the Bush administration, although it's arguable that we could go back quite a bit further than that with U.S. foreign policy, particularly in regard to the Middle East. But starting in 2000, when Mr. Bush took office in the United States, his policies immediately sent a warning to people, particularly in the Middle East, again, that this is an aggressive foreign policy. They are coming to the Middle East, starting with Afghanistan and then moving quickly to Iraq, and they are coming and they're coming to stay. And this, rather than taking the outpouring of support for the United States after the attacks of 9/11 and using that support, as you said, to bring all of the goodwill of America and its allies to do what they can to help stop this sort of thing from happening again by building more international bridges, providing more humanitarian relief, working with governments rather than bombing them, for example. They have gone the opposite track and used it as a green light to basically act unilaterally, particularly in regard to the Middle East, to do whatever they want, totally disregarding international support as they did by essentially just sticking their nose up at the UN after they didn't get the green light from them and going on ahead and invading Iraq anyhow. And this has sent a very clear message over here that America is acting as the rogue terrorist nation. They have the brute force and they will use it, and they don't need any allies to do it. And essentially that is what they have done, excluding Britain and just a few other countries that assisted them in invading Iraq. And the fear now is that they are going to, of course, continue to do so, meanwhile giving Ariel Sharon to use very heavy-handed tactics in Palestine. And they're doing the same thing here in Iraq, the U.S. military is, and everyone here fully expects that it's only a matter of time, because the Caspian Sea oil reserves are basically Iran and or Syria lie in between the neocon agenda to get to the Caspian oil sea reserves, and everyone here is well aware that Iraq is the footprint that the U.S. military will use to continue this push towards these oil reserves. That's what people here are saying, and that's what they believe, and that's what they fully expect to happen, especially now that Mr. Bush is in office for another 4 years. They expect this to happen sooner rather than later.
What kinds of things can we still do? How can we stop this? I mean, it does seem that this administration is doing what others in history have done, which is sort of consolidate economic forces around themselves and isolate themselves prior to major world war. That is a big concern of various journalists that I've been reading. And I would have to say, certainly the evidence is there that there is a consolidation of wealth and an isolation and a sort of a hunkering down and putting people around Bush who only agree with Bush. You have reported from Iraq for roughly 8 months' time, and stories about the dinar versus the dollar have come up. So you are certainly aware of the ramifications of oil, the dinar, the dollar, the euro, and how this is becoming a phenomenon of potential world war. Talk about that as you see it today amid all of the violence that's going on prior to the January 30th election.
Well, the economic situation that the U.S. has put itself in, essentially, America is already a bankrupt country. We have $8 trillion of debt, 30% of which is owned by China. And it's simply a matter of time before other countries decide that using the U.S. dollar as the base currency, the standard of measure, if you will, it certainly makes no economic sense. It is a political game that the U.S. has somehow managed that the dollar is the worldwide recognized currency. And that is starting to change. And if the U.S. plans, not the U.S., the neocon agenda in the Bush administration, if their plans of continuing north from Iraq are to be stopped, it is going to have to be economically, because everyone is all too aware of the fact that the U.S. has by far and away the most powerful military on the planet. No one even comes close. There will be no conventional war fought against the U.S., but economically, if there is going to be change to force this administration to change, it will be economically. People from inside the U.S. boycotting or using nonviolent civil disobedience to shut down companies to send a statement that, yes, we do want and need a change in policy, because this current policy is simply hurting too many people, both inside and outside of the United States. And other countries are starting to do this, particularly over in the Middle East, where American products are being boycotted more and more every day. I recently was in Egypt, and over there I tried to use dollars, for example, to pay for something, and people said, no, we only take euros. And this is starting to happen. The euro is now much, much stronger than the dollar and continues over the long run to gain over the dollar. And I believe it's just a matter of time before more countries start to switch from the dollar to the euro. And when that starts to happen in en masse, then we will see really the decline of the U.S., the true decline of the U.S. economy. And then the U.S. will lose all possibility of being able to repay any of its foreign debt. And then what we have is a situation where the value of the dollar just drops down through the cellar, and we have a situation that will resemble what happened in Argentina not too long ago. And all of a sudden, anyone with savings, all of a sudden, if you have $10,000 of savings and it's worth $2,000, what are people going to do? And really, from this aspect over here in Iraq, just from the Iraqi view, they see the effects of U.S. imperialism looking like, where in the 80s, the Iraqi dinar, it actually was worth $3.30. One Iraqi dinar was $3.30. Now the Iraqi dinar, it takes 1,500 Iraqi dinars to equal one U.S. dollar. So looking at it economically, it's very safe to say that Iraqis are all too aware that this imperialism, their country being invaded and taken over by the U.S., has done nothing but hurt them and their economy, to put it very mildly. And, of course, all of the surrounding countries in the Middle East are all too aware of that as well.
We've seen Condoleezza Rice in her confirmation hearings for Secretary of State talk about Venezuela, and it came as a surprise. Our senator in Connecticut, Christopher Dodd, talked with her briefly about Venezuela, and she attacked Chavez, the leader there, for human rights abuses. Just finally, Dar, comment on the whole nature of the discussion and the confusing issues going on here, you know, just in terms of what Americans are getting for news and how they have no concept of the deeply troubling problems that we're defining here.
Well, I will close with this, which would sum up a lot of that, and that is, I really wish that more Americans would travel, because no matter what country they went to, even if it was just to Mexico, for example, and certainly if they came over to Europe or over to Asia and undoubtedly the Middle East, they would see the level of anti-American sentiment. It's at a place where it's never been in history. Even I've done a lot of traveling in my time. I've been to many, many countries around the world, and traveling a few years ago compared to now, it's really amazing the change that I've seen. Everywhere you go, people, if you're a Bush supporter, God help you. People are so against this administration and their policies and very vocal about it, and in Europe is one of the places where it's been some of the most fierce opposition to this administration, and any traveler that goes there would see this right away. When I travel now, and I mean, I introduce myself, and when I tell people I'm an American, I immediately will say, yes, but I didn't vote for Bush. And then, of course, I'm greeted with smiles. Otherwise, I would have to prepare myself for a very long, heated argument, and I'm glad I don't have to do that. But it's imperative that the American people know what the effect this administration has had on the rest of the world and how America is viewed and how Americans themselves are viewed. It's a very, very sad thing because the principles that the United States is founded on, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, they're beautiful things. But this has changed. Everyone has seen the Bush administration policy in action throughout the world now, and it is doing nothing but losing America its favor and how Americans are viewed as used to be so welcomed all around the world. And now there is a deep distrust and a deep anger everywhere I've been since Bush has taken office and enacted his policies. And people need to be aware of this because when essentially every other country in the world is looking at America and saying the same thing, and it's only the Bush administration and the corporate media in the U.S. that is saying the other thing, we have to take stock and be honest and look who's probably right, the rest of the world or our one country and their administration.
Well, Dar, you have not done too much to lift my hopes. However, I am hopeful that so many dedicated and brave people like you are out there working to get information across the globe, and I just wish you the very best of luck in all of your work between now and the January election. I do hope we'll be able to contact you again.
Well, thanks very much, Dory. It's a pleasure talking with you, and I'm doing my best, and I'd be happy to talk to you again.
Take care, Dar.
Thanks, Dory. Talk to you soon.
You can read Dar Jamail's daily dispatches home from Iraq at darjamailiraq.com, D-A-H-R-J-A-M-A-I-L, Iraq.com. For The Crisis Vote, I'm Dory Smith. This program was produced at listener-supported WHUS Stores, FM 91.7 at UConn, the University of Connecticut. You can tune in to WHUS at whus.org.